The new movie Stillwater is getting Oscar buzz, but it's also causing controversy. Filmmakers have said the movie is inspired by the story of Amanda Knox, an American student who was exonerated on charges of murdering her classmate while studying abroad in Italy in 2007, after initially being convicted. Knox says the movie is using her story without her permission and contributing to the false idea that she was guilty. That's in a fictionalized movie, but questions are also coming up in a new wave of documentaries. Questions about the ethics of storytelling when real people are involved. We're talking about some of those ethical issues in filmmaking, fictional and documentaries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What responsibilities, if any, do you think filmmakers have to real-life people they depict in their movies? Does it matter depending on who that real-world person is, an ordinary person, say, versus a big-name celebrity? Is it okay for films about real-world events to take creative liberties that might not have happened in real life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Patricia Ofterheide is a communication studies professor at American University. She has studied ethics in documentary filmmaking. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
What a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I want to start in the fictional but inspired by category here with a listen to Amanda Knox's criticisms in her own words. Here she is speaking on NPR's All Things Considered earlier this month.
My identity is, first of all, associated with a series of events that I had nothing to do with. So anytime I try to speak about my own experience as a wrongfully convicted person, I am constantly put up against the victimhood of Meredith Kircher, whose own victimhood has in a large way been erased.
What do you think of this story about Stillwater? Filmmakers have mentioned Amanda Knox's name, but it's not really about her. And then we hear from Amanda Knox herself. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think I'm glad that Amanda Knox has been raising these issues because that story does involve her. And I think there are clear repercussions for her life, as should be completely obvious. And she has been the victim of false narratives since the beginning of the ordeal that she went through. So clearly, anything brings attention to her, and this episode in her life will naturally re-traumatize her. So then the question is, to what purpose? What is the public good that is served by doing that? Because you can imagine a situation where you do expose somebody, re-traumatize them, draw public attention to them again. It's a world of social media. She's going to get a lot of attention there. But for what purpose? And as far as I can tell, Stillwater is intended to be an entertaining mm-hmm. Crime drama. And I'm not understanding why she has what the ethical justification is for doing that to her.
Do you think, and sticking with fictional movies that depict or are related to real people, is there a different kind of ethical standard with a normal person, a non-famous person like Amanda Knox, versus a political figure, a celebrity, a rock star, you name it?
So I think I'm talking about ethics, and there's also law. Mm-hmm. And there are real differences between individuals, ordinary individuals, and celebrities in law. But I think we're just talking about whether it's decent, what's decent. Mm. And I think there are lots of reasons to examine the lives of public figures. I'm sure that when Henry Kissinger watched The Trials of Henry Kissinger, which is a documentary, that is not how Henry Kissinger would have ever told his story. It basically depicts Henry Kissinger as a war criminal. But the people who made that film also did a lot of research to make sure that what they were saying was not only not libelous, which would have got them in trouble, but also, not contestable. Their interpretation might be not what you or Henry Kissinger might have done, but they have a right to be able to interpret, because they think it is important in the public good to draw attention to the public behavior of a public man. So I do think it's different it's different ethically as well as legally between somebody who was expecting the kind of privacy that comes from the anonymity of an ordinary life, the relative anonymity of an ordinary life. But I think there's always a moral and an ethical responsibility to say, why are we doing this? What is the trade-off for invading people's lives here and exposing everyone to our interpretation of them?
We're talking to Patricia Ofterheide, communications studies professor at American University, looking at ethics in documentaries, which we'll get to in just a moment, and in fictionalized movies that tell some or all of a real person's life. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on those subjects at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Patricia, this Amanda Knox story that's been in the news, one of the reasons we called you. The other one that got us interested was this documentary on the late Anthony Bourdain, chef, travel documentary guy himself. And here's this documentary, and it came out that some of the things we hear Anthony Bourdain saying in the documentary, he never said. They were things he was quoted as saying or emails he'd written and then electronically redone versions of his voice reading these sentences. And that's raising some eyebrows. Before we get into wider issues in documentaries, what do you think of that particular case?
I thought there were so many things that were fascinating about this, not least that AI is kind of the cutting edge of deception. And you've probably also heard about this use of artificial intelligence in deep fakes. And some people might have seen that deep fake of Obama saying, "I didn't really say this," you know, which is a demonstration of how good AI can be in creating illusion. But clearly, a lot of people, when that happened, when Morgan Neville says to the New Yorker critic who's interviewing him, and she says, "How did you get that email of this confidential email of his? How did you get audio of him talking?" And he says, "Oh, that was AI," and she's like, "What?" And he says, "Oh, and there's more that you'll never find out about in the film," and she's like, "Well," and then he says, and she says, "Is that an issue for you?" And he says, "Listen, we can have a conversation. We can have a panel about it at some film festival afterwards, okay?" And that whole interaction was fascinating to me because clearly Morgan Neville, who's a very popular and very successful filmmaker, very well rewarded for making films that everybody loves. 20 Feet from Stardom was just a magnificent movie. Everybody should see it. So he doesn't care. He doesn't think anything bad is going to happen to him. He doesn't think it's in the least unusual or weird to be saying, "Well, you thought this was really like I was telling you real stuff about Anthony Bourdain, but I only made up the stuff I'm telling you about. I made up stuff I'll never tell you about." You know, and I'm fine with that. And so I really felt like this was a real marking moment because a lot of people came out on social media and said, "I'm not fine with it. I feel weird about that," which to me was an indication of what I had heard from filmmakers themselves when I did this big research project. And what they were saying was, "I want to be able to sleep with myself at night knowing that people wouldn't hate me once they found out how I made this movie. They wouldn't feel betrayed. They wouldn't feel like the rug had been pulled out from under them." And that's the feeling people got with this Anthony Bourdain stuff. They were like, "The rug just got pulled out from under me. I didn't think that was happening." So I think we've got this marking moment where the field is like, "We can do whatever we want to." And the audience is saying, "Actually, I have questions." And to me, that's exciting because that means that we're finally approaching a point in the field of documentary filmmaking that we could entertain the idea of something the field does not have, which is an ethics code.
And we'll pick up at that point in just a moment. Patricia Ofterheide is with us, communication studies professor at American University. She's with us today to talk about the ethics of movies about real people, both documentaries and fictionalized accounts or inspired by accounts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you watch a documentary, do you think of it as journalism? Do you think it's okay to fudge things a little bit to tell a bigger narrative, a bigger story, even if that means a bit of video that isn't necessarily what you thought it was, or audio in the case of the Anthony Bourdain story we were just hearing? Have you made documentaries or movies based on real life people yourself? What kind of decisions, questions did you face along the way? Call 800-642-1234. And do you watch lots of documentaries now? Because there's tons of them out there. Are you watching them and wondering what went into that? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about ethics in filmmaking, documentaries and fiction inspired by real people. Patricia Aufterheide stays with us from American University. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch a lot of documentaries? There are a lot of them available on a streaming service near you. Do you wonder about some of the ethical decisions made about how reality is portrayed or skewed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Patricia, you mentioned your research. This is from 10 years ago or so, talking to lots of documentary filmmakers. And this idea, and I hadn't really thought about it, there is not like a consistent code of behavior, what you do, what you don't do among documentary filmmakers. And what you heard from is they're all kind of winging it, it seems like.
Well, I think... what we discovered in our study was that people wanted to be able to behave in a certain way, but without a code and without standards in the field, they were hostage to market forces, and those market forces have only gotten so much more accelerated with the streamers, Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. And Peacock Plus and all of the streamers are looking to documentaries as relatively cheap ways to win reputation, awards, and audiences. Especially if you want to just get eyeballs, true crime is really the way to go. And there are so many fairly sleazy true crime series. Many people have watched Making a Murderer, which actually had the effect of creating a movement to demand the release of these two men who were accused of murder. And it's actually not clear that they didn't commit the murder. But the film is made in such a way as to really raise all your doubts about that in a way to completely make you side with them. And it's... It created a very confusing situation in terms of real life while providing immensely entertaining true crime entertainment. And Reed Hastings, who's on Netflix, Reed Hastings, who runs Netflix, you ask him about, you run these documentaries that are about, you know, umpteen important issues. Do you have any obligation to make sure that there's any accuracy there? He says, no. I'm an entertainment company. If I were the New York Times, it would all be different. But no, I don't have any obligation. So that's the world that filmmakers themselves are operating in. And also filmmakers are often given no journalistic training. And they are usually working for divisions of companies that are entertainment divisions, not the journalism side. So they're often lacking some of the basic expectations. And here's the kicker. Documentary is only documentary because it makes this claim to be representing reality accurately in some way. Not necessarily with fidelity, surveillance camera. It's a crafted piece of work, just like this show is, just like any article you ever read in a newspaper is crafted, and people have made decisions about what goes into it and what take they're going to make on it. So that doesn't get you away from the problem that it's documentary because you make a claim to reality. I would make the same argument about docudrama and about biopics, that you're making a claim to be representing reality there. And so you have some obligation to do that.
Let's go to our callers now. Tamarcus is with us in Eau Claire. Tamarcus, hi.
Hey, I just want to, real quick, I just started listening to you guys' podcast about 2 weeks ago, and I really enjoy it. Thanks. I just wanted to say I never really thought about the topic and the light you guys are putting it in, and just wanted to comment and question and say, when you do a biography on somebody as a writer, don't you have to go get that, get the permission from the actor or actress, whoever you or whoever it is that you're making a biography on, just like an artist would have to get permission from another artist to cover their song. So that's all I wanted to say.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Now, I know for writing biographies, there are sometimes authorized ones where you get full cooperation. You could write whatever you want, an unauthorized one without the cooperation. How much permission do documentary filmmakers get on whether and how to tell a particular person's story? The answer to that, from reading your older research, varies from maker to maker, right?
Well, there's also the law. If somebody's story is in the public domain, such as Amanda's was, you have no obligation to ask them anything. So ordinary people who had bad things happen to them often have their stories exploited, both for fiction and for nonfiction, and nobody needs to ask them anything or pay them anything legally. So that's where I was saying I was speaking from an ethical point of view. But from the viewpoint of celebrities, the reason why people get authorization and permission is to be able to get access to material they wouldn't be able to get on the public record, and to get prior permission to use some of the material that made that celebrity famous, for instance, a lot of their songs. We do have the right under fair use in copyright as creators of any kind to reference popular culture, to if you're playing a whole song, as the gentleman just suggested, if you're doing a cover of somebody else's song, you have to pay them for the right to sing that song. If you're taking a small clip of that song to make a point in a documentary or in a podcast or on a radio show, no, you don't need to pay them because you are reusing it in a way that's different. But in terms of getting permission from people, often filmmakers are working with somebody for a year at a time. And they will have signed a release at the beginning saying, I let you use my material. And they don't actually have any idea what they're getting into. They just, and neither does the filmmaker. The filmmaker doesn't know how big or small this piece will end up being. And so often people get into situations where they are now involved in this relationship for years, and how it works out really depends on the personal relationships. So and that's where ethics comes in more than law. It's like, how do you want to behave to this person when you tell their story to the world? What's going to happen if they think they were exploited? That's I think, what the most driving question is for most documentary filmmakers.
To Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Patricia, I want to stay with that point because I thought it was one of the most interesting things about your research. Different conditions, different filmmakers might say, you know what, this is something, a kid was seen doing something in my documentary that could haunt them for life. Maybe I owe it to them to take it out. Maybe I should talk to their family about it. In other cases, no conversation at all. Can you talk about some of the different opinions you heard on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like when it's quote important people, when it's celebrities, filmmakers spend a lot of time saying, well, do we really want to talk about that? I mean, what's his name from the Rolling Stones just died? The
Charlie
drummer.
Watts. Yep.
Thank you, Charlie Watts. Okay, so Charlie Watts started having a relationship with his second wife when she was 13 years old. That, as far as I can tell, is you know, molesting a child. And that created some news that has created a whole undercurrent of comment. You did not see that in Charlie Watts' biography, his obits. So when it's important people, quote unquote, then we pay a lot of attention to how discreet we're going to be about some things that they've done. And I really believe, I think that filmmakers believe that if they could do it, they should give that same consideration to the people who are in their storytelling care, so to speak. That the question that was asked about that one incident where the kid had done something for which he was arrested was, is the arrest and the criminal incident germane, relevant, and central to the story I'm telling? If it is, it probably has to go in, if I have permission of the family. But because he's a minor. but if it isn't, why am I doing that to him? Because it's going to haunt him forever. This will be public forever. So that I thought was very good, and a good example of ethical thinking, where the difference is really, what's the trade-off between the public good and the concerns, the legitimate concerns of the person I'm telling the story about?
And Patricia, just in our last few moments, are you hoping to see somebody, documentary makers or whoever, get together and establish solid codes? Just in our last half a minute or so.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is, I think we're seeing a coalescing of interest, not only on the part of audiences, like the people who were outraged about the Anthony Bourdain documentary, but also on the part of filmmakers. Filmmakers have been organizing in these little subgroups, like disabled filmmakers and Asian filmmakers and producers. And there's a BIPOC group of filmmakers, and they've been working on these statements and manifestos and community letters that start to lay out some rules of the road. And I think that leaves the door open for what I think is really the next step, which is for a membership organization to be able to take action to establish some kind of commonly shared values by which we make our ethical reasoning. And I really hope that happens.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Patricia.
Thank you.
That's Patricia Alfterheide, Communication Studies Professor at American University, with us today to talk about ethics in filmmaking. A quick bit of research. Not Charlie Watts, but Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones apparently had that relationship with an underage girl, just to clarify.